welcome to Cairo Nights. News Boss Frank Shires here, as is Chairman of the Board, Shane Peterson. I am Mike Lewis, and it was a, it felt a little bit, to me anyway, like the fourth quarter of a Super Bowl earlier today, when I was waiting on the Mars lander. It was, I gotta say, the live footage from Mission Control was gripping. It was really exciting. And in fact, we've got a little bit of that audio right now. If you missed it, the Mars rover Perseverance landed on Mars today. And it is, even though we've done it before, we haven't done it much. And every time you do it, and this is a big, this is the beginning of a big, expensive, complicated project to really actually search for if there ever was any form of life on Mars. Get samples and somehow retrieve those samples and bring them back to Earth on a later mission. All of it is exceptionally cool stuff, but let's just listen to Mission Control for just a minute.
Touchdown confirmed. Yes. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life. The descent stage has flown away to a safe distance. Perseverance is continuing to transmit direct through Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to Earth.
And if you get a chance to watch some of that video, please... please do, especially if you have kids. It is dynamite. Remember that these folks haven't just been paying attention to this thing while it was on its multi-month mission from Earth to Mars. These folks have been paying attention to this thing for a decade, because that's when these projects are usually started, conceived, the software begins to be written, the devices begin to be built. All of the decisions about what tools are going to go on it, what sort of things it's going to be able to accomplish, which ones it isn't. And remember, this one actually has a helicopter. It's the first flight ever, at least by something man-made on Mars, will be happening shortly. As the rover streaked through the Martian sky and landed on the planet on Thursday, accomplishing the riskiest step yet in the quest to bring back rocks that could answer whether life ever exists on Mars. This is from CBS space consultant Bill Harwood.
When Perseverance landed on Mars, you could almost feel the wave of relief that swept across the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where hundreds of engineers worked for years to build, launch, and land the most complex rover ever sent to another world. All that work paid off with a hair-raising but near flawless 7-minute descent to the floor of an ancient crater where a body of water the size of Lake Tahoe once stood, and where the remnants of past microbial life might well be preserved. It'll take more than a month to fully check out Perseverance and get it ready for years of exploration, but the mission's off to a great start.
So the agency has completed other missions on Mars. This is a $2.7 billion robotic explorer, and it's called Perseverance. It has scientific tools that will bring advanced capabilities to the search for life beyond Earth. The rover's about the size of a car, and it can use both sophisticated cameras, lasers that can analyze the chemical make, more on that later, but lasers that can analyze the chemical makeup of Martian rocks, ground-penetrating radar to identify the chemical signatures of fossilized microbial life that may have thrived on Mars when it was a planet full of flowing water. This is from Lori Glaze, the NASA Director of Planetary Science. She says, quote, "Now the fun really starts." NASA's earlier missions showed that the planet had some, in its distant past, had some places that were warm, wet, and habitable. It is now time to learn whether or not there were any microscopic inhabitants there. This is from Kenneth Wilford. He's a deputy project scientist on the mission. He said during a news conference today, quote, "It's an enormous undertaking that's in front of us. It has enormous scientific potential to be really transformative. The question is, was Mars ever a living planet. And that is what the core mission is in this particular pursuit. Mars has been the focus of more interest from other folks as well. The United Arab Emirates and China both began orbiting the planet last month, joining an armada of European and American spacecraft already studying it from space. And private entrepreneurs are looking forward to the neighboring world. This is from the New York Times, such as Elon Musk, who has talked about this a lot and actually sent out a lot of congratulatory notes today. You know, and other people, and Jeff Bezos, assuming that maybe someday humans could live there. The rover is going to set in motion a bigger project that NASA's plan is to be carried out over the next decade. And the mission is to bring back samples from Mars back to Earth, making it by far the most valuable minerals on Earth, where scientists will have even more capabilities to find something signaling that our planet is not the only place where life has ever been found. But we will see. Now, yesterday, if you were listening to the show, I invited on Professor Tim Elam. He's a physicist at the University of Washington. If you look at the graphics about the Mars rover, one of the key instruments on it is called the Pixel. It is a spectrometer. It's supposed to be able to, or does identify chemical elements to search for signs of past life on Mars. This is the guy who designed that. He actually led the project to do that. He's here at the University of Washington. This is a little bit what he had to say yesterday about how nervous he was about the landing.
Well, the way a friend of mine who's been involved in previous Mars missions described this is it's very exciting, but it's also very nerve-wracking. And I've kind of taken that as my description of this process. I feel like I'm a little bit on the rack and getting my nerves stretched, but, you know, it's sort of equal parts, excitement and concern.
And so what you've got on the Mars rover is, let me just give you a sort of a list of things that we're going to get. And like they said in the newscast, it's going to be a few days. They're not going to know. For example, Professor Elam was explaining in the broadcast that they will know in about a week whether or not how well their instrument is working. They're assuming it's working fine, but it takes a little while to send one. There's a lag time when you send commands. It takes about 10 minutes to get there. There are other sort of housekeeping things that need to be done to get the rover up and moving around and all of the cameras working and all of the software coordinated. But then they will actually be able to start determining where they're going to go and where they're going to use the spectrometer to figure out how or what is the composition of some of these rocks. So it's got the Ingenuity on Perseverance is the Ingenuity helicopter. It's a 4-pound aircraft that's going to communicate wirelessly with the rover and fly around for aerial observation. It's got its antenna is going to transmit all the data to Earth. Its mast is what you'll be seeing when you're seeing pictures of the Martian surface from this. It's from the mast camera. It's be able to do panoramas and photographs. Its laser is going to study the composition of the Martian rocks. The Pixel, which we just talked about, Professor Elam's project, that's going to be on the front of the rover. Well, I don't know. I guess the rover can go any direction, so I'm not sure that's always going to necessarily be the front. And the robotic arm has a turret with many instruments attached to it. It's 7 feet long. The drill will extract samples from the Martian rocks. The Sherlock device will identify molecules and minerals to detect potential biosignatures with help from the Watson camera. The rover weighs 2,200 pounds, and it's going to the Jezero crater. Where it is going to be spending most of its existence. Now, its warranty from NASA gives it about a 2-year lifespan. But what we've seen in past rovers is that they've been so well built that they've tripled their expected their life expectancy. And so the hope here is that they don't just get the minimum of 2 years, but they figure in 2 years they can do the experiments they need to do. They're more hoping that this is going to last quite a bit longer than that. So hats off to Jet Propulsion Laboratory and to NASA and everyone involved in that project, including folks over at the University of Washington, because that is it's a dynamite moment. And if you do, like I said before, if you do get a chance, take a look at the video, especially follow it in from a few minutes out and just watch how the tension in the room is just like everyone is completely nervous. And then that release when they finally get that thing touching down is pretty magic. Less magic would be Republican Senator Ted Cruz, who is being called Marie Antoinette, among other things, on social media after taking his family on a vacation to Cancun, while Texas remained paralyzed in a winter storm that's led to quite a few fatalities. This is from CBS News correspondent Janet Schmillion.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz arriving back in Houston under police escort. Less than 24 hours after he was spotted on a flight to Cancun, escaping the outages.
Yesterday, my daughters asked if they could take a trip with some friends, and Heidi and I agreed, so I flew down with them last night, dropped them off here, and now I'm headed back to Texas.
There was outrage after these photos became public. CBS News has learned Cruz was originally scheduled to return Saturday, not today. Janet Schmillion, CBS News, Houston.
He did not just fly down with his daughters. Apparently, somebody, and this is the funny thing about Ted Cruz, he is not particularly well liked by Republicans or Democrats in the Senate. He was, I think one senator once referred to him as the guy at work who microwaves fish. He seems to be like purely self-interested and not much of a, even if you don't agree with what team he's on, even his own team members or party members find the guy a little hard to take from time to time because he's so aggressively self-interested, and that is not an unusual quality, obviously, in Washington. And somebody else said out on Twitter, "Is there are two types of people on the planet, people who hate Ted Cruz and Ted Cruz. And this is one of those things that I think, is this going to hurt his long-term political future? I don't know. I mean, this has been kind of a consistent behavior by the guy since he's been in office. He had a very close race against Beto O'Rourke, who is, I wouldn't say, the most talented politician Texas has produced either. And he ran neck and neck with Ted Cruz in the senatorial race. It is going to be really interesting to see what happens with Ted Cruz over the long haul, because he, like Josh Hawley from Missouri, a few others, Nikki Haley as well, who are positioning themselves as the inheritor of the GOP nomination for president whenever that happens, obviously the next election. And Ted Cruz wants to be out in front. I'm not sure how the Cancun vacation is going to affect that. I mean, no one can really tell you at this point. I think that the prognosticators who frequently were in error predicting about how various things would affect Donald Trump, and they were wrong, except toward the end where things began really piling up on the former president. It's a dangerous business to try and predict that people will be outraged who maybe already know these things and maybe feel like, well, from a policy standpoint, they're pretty comfortable with the guy and they're going to move ahead. I will say this, though. He does not carry the charisma of the former president. He doesn't have that sort of white hot, he can do anything sort of support. And so my guess is that his missteps will cost him a little bit more. I mean, here's a good example. So he and his wife are sending out text messages. His wife primarily is sending out text messages, at least from what the New York Times said, text messages regarding planning this trip to Cancun to get out of the lousy weather situation, an emergency, declared emergency in Texas. And someone then leaked in their message group, in their friend message group, leaked the text messages out. So they had actually been planning this for a while. And it's pretty clear from the text messages that the senator was not planning on coming back right away, that this was a planned, like, hey, it's lousy here. Let's go somewhere nice. We'll stay at the Ritz, which is where they're staying in Cancun, and wait out the rest of the storm. But it's odd to me that, I mean, and maybe this is true for all of us. Maybe we don't know our friends as well as we would think. But wow, the fact that one of your friends leaks your family text messages out is something that tells a lot about how well regarded you are, even within your closest circle. The public outrage mounted has been mounting all day. People have been calling him Fled Cruz. In Texas, he sought to deflect the blame from the lack of the preparedness, and he has been Well, I guess here's the point about Ted Cruz. We'll see what happens to him. He's back now in the state. He got caught, a lot of photos of him both getting to Mexico and then by himself quietly coming back. It's going to be interesting to see whether it happens. But if you remember, we have seen these sort of things happen by a variety of politicians. I mean, Gavin Newsom in California dining at the French Laundry after he told everyone to stay home. I mean, that was one of those examples. Whether or not this hurts these people over the long haul, I guess it remains to Texans to figure out what they like and what they don't like. Now, what the Texans do like today is a little bit of good news. And the little bit of good news is power was restored to the homes and businesses and states that left millions without power, 4 million at the peak, I think 4.1 million at the peak. And in temperatures that left people literally with icicles, frozen toilets, frozen sinks in their own homes and nowhere to go. 325,000 today, 325,000 homes and businesses remain without power, which is down from 3 million a day earlier. Although utility officials say a limited rolling blackouts were still possible. This is from CBS News correspondent Janet Schmollen.
More than 13 million, almost half the state's population, have water issues. In many homes, the tap is dry.
It's been a little crazy. We got a ton of dirty dishes piled up. It's been really hard with flushing toilets, obviously.
Finding bottled water nearly impossible, some using snow.
So here I've added some more ice.
Houston opening 11 sites today, giving away water.
You have water? No.
But food is hard to come by. Long lines, often bare shelves.
This is Walmart, guys.
Tonight, frustration boiling over. Janet Shamlian, CBS News, Houston.
And so there is, this is the type of thing that it isn't necessarily going to happen everywhere. There's something, a couple things specific to Texas, and then other things that you see these sort of things happen in California to a lesser degree up here, but in other places in the country when you have severe weather. This is not just the result of severe weather. So there has been sort of an action plan put together by energy experts who have said this is what needs to happen in these to prevent these circumstances in Texas and elsewhere. One is really build your system to be able to plan for the extremes in weather, because this is when people are going to need it the most. It says one of the reasons that the grid had been so ill-equipped to handle the surge in power demand is that the agency that runs the grid there used past winters as their reference point. And that didn't make a whole lot of sense, because you have to plan for that once in a lifetime thing as well, that your grid can handle it. The other main thing that it recommended was get back on the federal grid, because this was the problem. Is Texas had nowhere to go when it was depleted of power because it's not connected to the federal grid. And that was one of the big mistakes, because it would have offset a lot of the problems in Texas if they had been able to do that. And so there you go. It was somewhat natural and somewhat man-made, and the hope is that folks there react accordingly and build a grid system that can actually help out the people, because this disproportionately hurts the poorest people in any condition, and certainly in Texas in this particular case. Coming up, we've got Rachel Bell. This is an interesting subject. There is new evidence that maybe we're taking too many showers, and maybe we're actually making our bodies less healthy by our aggressive, constant cleaning nature. That will be right after the break.
It's on America's tortured brow that Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again.
You can ring my bell.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. We are going to, Rachel and I here, are going to talk about a story here, and we are not trying to let you folks know that we are relaxing our personal hygiene in any way, but But we still need to have a conversation about it. Right,
yes,
Rachel?
Yes, where we are still washing our hands. We may not washing our armpits, is I guess what this story is. Yeah. This story is not COVID adjacent at all. It comes from something I've never heard of called Mel Magazine. And the name of this article is What Would Happen If You Never Showered With Soap? So they let these two guys take over the article. One of them's name is James Hamblin. He's a doctor. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. And he wrote a book called Clean, The New Science of Skin. James stopped washing his body with soap 5 years ago and doesn't think that he'll go back. The other person is named Jack Gilbert. He is a microbial ecology professor in California, and he wrote a book called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. So just to put it out there that these two experts, it's not just a hippie story. So one of the things that I thought was really interesting, just to kind of start this off, was the article explained why it is that you have BO, basically, which I never really knew before. So what it is this. So when your kidneys break down amino acids, which is protein, the byproduct or one of the byproducts is ammonia. So the two ways your body gets rid of the ammonia is either by peeing it out or sweating it out. And so when you sweat it out, there are these certain kind of microbes that like to feast on this ammonia. And basically, they're the ones that release the odor. So they're saying it's kind of like their byproduct in a way. So it's like these microbes are like pooping in your armpit, I guess. So that's basically why you smell. But these two guys argue that when you use soap, and I think a lot of people have heard this by now, mostly about antibacterial gel, that you're killing off the good bacteria. And what that can do to your skin, because you're killing also all this natural oil and moisture that keeps you hydrated. So they think that a lot of skin diseases, things like, you know, eczema, you know, psoriasis, all those things could be caused by overwashing, or just which is to us normal amount of washing. So you're messing with your skin's pH. So basically, James Hamblin, the one who says he hasn't washed in 5 years, he starts by saying that A, his wife likes how he smells. B, when he was writing his book, he asked a lot of people if he stunk, and he said most people said that he didn't. And C, that instead of soap, you can still scrub yourself in the shower, like with a washcloth, and for your hair, instead of using shampoo, if you brush it, then it brings up the natural oils. I wanted to talk about this just because these kinds of stories intrigue me, because I think that America is obsessed with cleanliness. All we're trying to do all the time is keep all dirt out of our homes and off of our bodies, and everyone is obsessed with being the least amount of natural as possible. So a couple years ago, because of a podcast episode I did, I interviewed an Ayurvedic teacher, and Ayurveda is this ancient thousands years old Indian way of living. And she told me that I should stop washing with soap, only to wash under my arms and between my legs and my feet if they were dirty. And so for the past few years, I haven't washed my whole body with soap.
And what have you noticed?
And I'm totally fine. Because she said it was just so drying. And like, I do believe very heartily that there are parts of your body that do need to be washed.
Right.
You know, I really believe that. And whether that's destroying the microbes in those regions, so be it. I'm not going to stop washing those parts. But I don't need to wash my legs unless there's dirt on them if I go camping. I don't need to wash my arms. Nobody has a stinky arm.
Right.
I don't think.
Right. No. That's an excellent point. I mean, if we're what we're trying to do is get rid of the odor, then that's pretty location specific, right? I mean, it's not necessarily something that is everywhere. I think that there's some truth to this. I know that early on when they started producing antibacterial soap, my reflexive reaction was like, wait a minute. One, all soap is antibacterial to a degree. But two, like, at what point are we doing more harm than good by not allowing our bodies to develop any sort of natural symbiosis with all the stuff that's out there on the planet anyway? If all we're doing is essentially nuking every possible bit of bacteria that we're going to run into anyway, it seems like that's probably not a healthy way. It may sound counterintuitive, but it's not necessarily a healthy way to live.
Yeah, we're just learning in the last 10 years about, you know, microbes in general. And I think a lot of people now have heard about, you know, all of the flora and fauna in your gut and how that could actually affect depression and your weight and all of these different things. And it's the same on your skin. It's the same kind of microbes. So the thing that I take from this is just to question why you do things. I think that there's so many things we do in life and society just because we've been marching in that parade since we were born. But like, think about it before you do it. Like, why do I wash? do I need to wash? Which to me kind of extends into a lot of environmentalism. Like, you know, do I need to use this bag at the grocery store to put my bananas that have a natural casing on them already in a plastic bag? Like, just question yourself why you do things. And I think there's this natural reaction to just, ew, everything in our society. And weren't you saying that on Twitter, there's like a big, big controversy about washing your legs?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You could see, like, there's arguments about whether or not you should or shouldn't wash your legs and do or don't wash your legs. And I think the conventionalist, I mean, I'll rinse off. I will, but I do a lot of cycling, so there's a lot of times that it just gets a lot of spattered from the road and dirt like that, and sure, I'm going to wash that off. But even then, sometimes it just needs a rinsing. It doesn't necessarily need to be scrubbed. I mean, it's not like I've been rolling around in oil. I mean, you know, at least not then. You know, it's more that I think that I think you're right. We do this over cleansing business, and I think we do it to our own detriment.
And in this article, they point out, which is no surprise, the whole concept of BO, like that, those two initials were created by soap marketing. So there's a lot of that in our society where we're told things are the way they are. And they started with ads and marketing, but it was so long ago that nobody really remembers. And they also point out that, and you know, people are familiar with the concept of pheromones, like giving off chemical signals is a big part of being a human and interpersonal communication. And so if you're always scrubbing away your natural smell, and then on top of it, covering it up with deodorant and perfume and the smell of hair products and lotion, then it's kind of interesting. I wonder how we're relating to people different in the world than our ancestors were, who weren't covering up their scents or eliminating them.
No, I think that's true. And also, so that one guy who wrote about, you know, he decided to stop bathing and talked about that first that first troubling month where definitely his body was not in balance and he was smelling pretty bad. But then his body sort of rounded a corner and its natural sort of ability to regulate. One of the people that I knew in my life like that, my dad, who showered regularly, I mean, it was like he was that guy, but he never used deodorant. And I don't recall one time the guy smelling bad. And he worked physical labor. I mean, it wasn't like he was working in an office. And my mom brought that. Mom and I talked about that once. And he's like, he never had used it, didn't use it. And consequently, his body never developed this sort of weird dependency on it. Because it feels like sometimes that's what you're doing, is you're recalibrating your body to the chemical and not the other way around.
Exactly. Yeah. I dated someone who didn't use deodorant and it was the same. He never smelled bad. The thing I learned about deodorant too is, you know, if you wear a white shirt and you might get like the yellow pit stains, that's actually from deodorant. That's not from your body. So
yeah,
if you
right.
didn't wear deodorant, you wouldn't have those stains.
Well, there you go. Now I know. And when I don't shower this weekend and someone blames me, I'm just going to say, you go talk to Rachel about this.
Yeah, Rachel did it. Let's end this segment on me talking about armpit stains.
Yeah, let's do that.
That's right. How I like it.
All right, Rachel. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
More Cairo Nights right after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. I can promise you this is not the last you're going to hear of this story, either on Cairo Nights or anywhere else. In today's Scientific American, which is one of my favorite websites, you ever seen the movie Inception? So think along these lines. Scientists have managed to do a study in which they have communicated back and forth with people who were currently, from a medical standpoint or from a sleep standpoint, completely asleep, that they've managed. Now, we've talked a little bit, and scientists have talked for a long time about lucid dreaming, that people who can be in a dreams can sometimes manipulate those dreams, learn how to manipulate those dreams and do what they want to do, even though they are in a full sleep state. And there has been a couple of indications that they can sometimes hear commands or words from people who are not sleeping while they are sleeping, but their ability to communicate back has always been limited because usually you have to get to your conscious self before you can do that. Well, apparently that is not true exclusively anymore. So let me just read you this. This is from Northwestern University, a very recent study. The scientists and their colleagues recruited volunteers and asked them to learn how to lucid dream. They provided them guidance on how to have lucid dreams. They were also trained to respond to simple math problems by moving their eyes back and forth. They say, for example, 8 minus 6, you're moving your eyes to the left and right twice, right? While the participants slept, electrodes attached to their faces, picked up their eye movements, and they put EEG sensors on their head to monitor brain activity and kept track of what stage of sleep they were in. When they got into deep sleep, they began asking these folks questions to get answers provided. So overall, they used 36 participants in 158 trials over three different countries. And they communicated the math problem to people in a variety of ways, one through Morse code, through tapping. And they found that 18% of the times the dreamers, and they are medically in a dream at that point, at least according to the brain monitors, they would respond. Now, some of the thinking is that these folks didn't necessarily remember this when they got up, but that they would. That the 60% who weren't actually responding may have been trying to, but not really, you know, clear on how to respond. Like they weren't able to make that computation in their head. But scientists said it seems pretty clear that there is an ability to communicate with people who are having a dream and even instruct them on what to do in their dream. And which brought me back to the movie Inception and whether or not you could actually communicate with somebody, sort of tap into their head, hack their head while they are asleep and be able to communicate with them. And I'm not sure how I think about that. I mean, I do wish that we could have a little more control over our dreams. It would be nice to use your dream to, I don't know, to experiment with something, to wake up. I mean, I don't know about you, but I know that when I have a bad dream or when I have a good dream, it does definitely affect my mood the next day. And so it's always nice to have one that where you did something really great or really fun or really unusual, and you wake up kind of in a good mood. And you probably had those dreams where you really had a great experience with somebody in the dream, not to get too graphic, and you end up like feeling kind of better about that person. And that's actually pretty great. And then you've also had dreams. I mean, my girlfriend does this a lot. I don't have these dreams quite so much. But she will sometimes be in a dream where someone has really bugged her. And she'll wake up sort of irritated with them, which is always pretty funny to me. I don't. You know, whenever I have a bad dream, weirdly enough, I wake up in a really good mood because whatever the situation was, whether it was scary or whether it was troubling or whether I'd forgotten to do something or I'd lost something important, all those sort of things that you stress about in your dreams, when I wake up and it's not true, I'm immediately relieved and actually in a pretty good mood as a result. But this is so interesting that we would be able to communicate with people while they are sleeping. And I don't know. I mean, and the article doesn't get into what this would serve. I think that there's a belief that there might be therapeutic value in this, especially for people with PTSD. I know that. I know that there'd be a, you know, just the whole understanding of consciousness is one of the other things that the researchers have talked about. So I'm guessing that there is something there, that this isn't just a cool thing to sort of figure out. And when they actually get to the place where they're getting maybe a higher level and more consistent communication, well, like then maybe I guess we'll figure out what the need for all of that is. Coming up, this is going to be something I think you folks are really going to enjoy. I sat down earlier today with a guy named, well, not sat down, I mean, we're both sitting down, but on Skype away from each other, Dr. Ronald Crutcher. He is the president of the University of Richmond. His new book, I Had No Idea You Were Black, is about leadership and about tackling those really thorny problems that you'll run into. And it just doesn't apply to African-Americans. This applies to all of us. And the book is dynamite. He's going to be on right after the break. Please stay tuned.